Yeah, but it didn't have the other magazine section in this city.
Okay.
Somebody who knows the paper said if you send an article that's important, they'll put it in the just the paper. They'll run it.
The regular paper, because they don't have their own magazine?
No.
Okay. A friend of mine from New Orleans suggested that Times-Picayune might be a good one.
Oh, well, yeah, Times-Picayune is a good one. That's my hometown.
Okay.
Hey, I know they're listening to
it. Okay, good enough. Now, let's get this down on tape. What I would do is ask you to say who you are and start off by saying where you were born and what your folks did and how you got into the service, and then just kind of take it a step at a time from there. Okay, could you state for the record who you are?
My name is Hayward, H-A-Y-W-A-R-D. I say Ward because a lot of people spell my name W-O-O-D. Louis Aubrey, O-U-B as in boy, R-E, Junior. So I'm named after my father.
Okay. And what part of the country were you brought up in?
I was brought up in New Orleans, Louisiana, where I was born. And I went to school in New Orleans. American Missionary Association schools. I went to Daniel Hand and Straight College. They are no longer in existence. Straight College merged with New Orleans University, a church school formed Dillard University. And as I entered Dillard University in 1935, they chose a student from the upper 10% of the classes there. And I majored in art. I was the first major in art. I was the only member of the class. I was just a teacher and a student. Of course, my father didn't want me to major in art because he thought I'd starve to death and be a drag on him. He wanted me to go to pre-med school, but I've always wanted to be an artist even before I knew what art was. And when I really made up my mind to be an artist, I saw Michelangelo's work at the Delgado Museum, at the cast of his work. And I just couldn't believe what he did. From then on, I was inspired to be an artist. And now that I'm an artist, I have some fortunate things that are happening to me out of Boston, New York, which I'll answer and talk to you if we have time today. So I've always had a job, so my father's words didn't come true.
What did your father do?
My father was a mail clerk in the main post office in New Orleans, Louisiana. That's because he was there for years.
And had he gotten a chance to get some education? Must have.
I went to Daniel Hand in State College, which was located on the widest business street in New Orleans, Canal Street. There's a history there. And my mother and father both went to high school there. They met there, and they married before they fell in love and married before they could finish.
Uh-huh.
But they both attended high school.
Okay, and you went from Louisiana to college in Iowa?
No, I went to college in New Orleans.
Okay.
Then I went to Atlanta University to study under Hale Woodruff, who studied in Paris, France, and Elizabeth Prophet, who studied sculpture in France. They had an art department there because the President John Hope wanted to bring cultural things to Atlanta. So I had a chance to study under two good teachers the next year and a half. And
What year was that? Do you remember?
Pardon?
What year was it about?
I went there the fall of 1939 after I finished college in Dillard.
Okay.
And I spent a year and a half. And Hale Woodruff was the man who established an art exhibit annually for the black artists in the South, and especially in Atlanta, so that we could exhibit, because white museums and galleries and universities would not hang our work. So he did that, and there's an art collection there, the biggest art collection for black artists in America. And I won 8 times. When I say 8 times, each prize was a purchase prize, and they have now the collection on exhibit there. They say my work is continuously on exhibit in Atlanta.
And what media do you prefer?
I worked in etchings, and that's where my work has been sold, and we'll get into that in New York, and how I was picked up by from Who's Who in American Art and so forth. But I worked in etching with the Lasansky, one of the outstanding etchings sketches in that was brought to America. He was a foreigner.
Okay.
Which I'm jumping the gun a little bit and saying that after I spent 3 years, 2 months and 15 days, I got that from my honorable discharge, I went to the University of Iowa. I was sent there by a former professor of mine and my wife, who majored in drama in New Orleans, and I majored in art. And I was told that I had a diversified major, and I didn't know what that was. He said, you majored in art, but you had enough hours to have a diversified major in drama, too. So I did that, and my wife and I met, and we had the same background. And when I went to Atlanta, I was called to Tuskegee Institute. You know about that?
Yes.
It's a very famous school. I met Dr. Carver there. And it was unusual because Dr. Carver wouldn't talk to people. They put young men around him for him to be interested in them, but he wasn't interested in anybody unless they were creative, I was told. And a lady by the name of Mrs. Walcott, who was chairman of the English department at Tuskegee, stopped me one day. I knew before. I spoke to her when I passed. But she said, Mr. Uber, I want to talk to you. And I said, what is it, Mrs. Walcott? She said, I want you to talk to Dr. Carver. I said, Dr. Carver won't talk to me. I said, that man is busy all the time. I told her I'd gone to the Carver Museum many times, and I'd seen the letters that he'd received. I saw what he had done with the peanut and the potato, and that inspired me to no end, because I couldn't believe what I saw there. I just go stand there and look at it every day and say, my God, how can this man do this? And so when she told me that she would arrange a time for me to see Dr. Carver, she said what impressed her, and I was looking at them today. I made some bookends on the campus because I was brought there for a creative program there by Dr. J. Max Bond. I don't know if you've heard of him. He and his brother raced to get PhDs. Dr. J. Max Bond was the first dean at Dillard, and J. Max Bond, his brother, came there after him. You've heard of Julian Bond, haven't you?
Sure.
Well, Julian Bond is the son of Horace Mann Bond. He looks like him and talks like him. So I knew he both fathers there. Dr. J. Max Bond was very fine to me. When I went there, he said, I'm bringing you here to do creative work for me. He said, I knew you at Dillard, and you were the first major in art there, and I was. He said, I have some things I want you to do. So he called me to his office and talked to me and told me about the ideas, and I'd go home and make a sketch, and I'd go back. He said, that's precisely what I want. I wish I could draw. And then he'd get something there because I thought it was very good. He took that basement of the dining hall, that huge building that President did it. Made the bricks, you know, if you heard about it.
Right.
Famous man, I don't know why I can't call his name. Booker T. Washington. And he said, we're going to make a sort of a student union here. And so one time I went over there, and he had his knickers on, and they had some scaffolds, and they were painting the place to make it look good after I designed some furniture to go in there. And this is what he did, and this was unusual in those days. Although he had a PhD, when I wanted to go get a brush to work on the scaffolding, he said, oh, no, not you. You create. Let those of us paint who cannot do things, he said, you just do that work for me. Now, how I got into the Army. I transferred my draft notice to be given to me in Tuskegee from New Orleans. And they transferred it. I was drafted in the Army in July from Tuskegee. And
what grade or what status were you at Tuskegee?
I was there to study, and I was supposed to have gotten a grant to study in grad school. See, I had no means of going to grad school as far as scholarships are concerned, but he said because of having known how good I was at Dillard and having a major in art, that they would give me some sort of grant money from Tuskegee after I finished this project that I was working with Dr. J. Max Bond with. But in the meantime, in July, they drafted me into the Army, and I had to leave overnight. They told my mother if I wasn't in New Orleans the next day, they would put me in jail, because at that time, they were putting black guys in the Army, right and left. So I got in on the train, and I got into New Orleans the next day, and I was drafted into the Army. And we went from there to Mississippi, Camp Shelby, a big tent city, and that's where I was inducted. And also, after we were there, They brought us into a large room, and there were a lot of young white men interviewing the black soldiers to be, because the army was totally segregated then. And as a young man was talking to me in a nice manner and asking me questions, I said, "Pardon me, may I ask you a question?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Why are you interviewing me? I've been drafted to the army. They told me I had to come to the army. But why are you being so kind to me?" He said, "We're just doing that to make you feel good. All of you are going to Fort Belvoir, Virginia, to be trained to be general service engineers." So I learned that from talking to him. And sure enough, they sent us all to Belvoir, which was a beautiful camp right out of Virginia.
And then...
George Washington's home, because our first hike was to Mount Vernon, to George Washington's home. And after I got there, I made such a good record, they wanted me to stay there to be a sergeant, a drill sergeant. And I didn't like the army. I didn't like the drilling. I didn't ever like that. And the lieutenant said, I told him I'd rather take my chances and go out with the men I had started soldiering with. And about a week before we were leaving, he said, "I still can offer you a rating for Carville." And I told him, "No, I thought I should go on out." And I went on out. And they sent us to the 97th Engineer Outfit. And strange enough, if you look at my number, my serial number, it's 304-3407-9797. I have a double 97. And I went into the 97th Engineer Battalion. It was a battalion when I went into it. And then it got large and became a regiment by the time we got to Alaska. But before we went to Alaska, we went to Camp Blandin, Florida. And from there, we were sent to Eglin Field, Florida. That was a big camp, but we were surely segregated in the wilderness, and we had to make our own new camp. So we did. And we were preparing then to go do the work of engineers in Alaska. But in the meantime, while I was there, Army said they wanted a very intelligent, a very responsible soldier to guard the plane that had the Norden bomb sight. You've heard of that? Mm-hmm. The bomb sight that was so good that they could drop the bombs more accurately?
Uh-huh.
And what they did for me, I was a private man. They had a spotlight at Eglin Field Air Base with a bomber that had a twin tail on it. I always used to like to see that plane. It was a beautiful plane. I don't know what the number was. But I walked around there for hours in that spotlight, which meant I could have been taken out easily. But the thing about it was, early in my career, the person who was in charge of our outfit selected me because they wanted a responsible man. So I thought that was a good thing, that I was establishing a good rapport with the commissioned officers by being a dutiful soldier.
Right. And did you have any idea you were going to Alaska at that point, or...?
No, we didn't know.
No, okay.
But,
and when did they send you off?
They sent us, we left America on July, that we went to Washington, the state of Washington, to a POE camp, Port of Embarkation. And we stayed there a day or two. We got on a ship, and we went into Valdez, Alaska.
Was it a fancy ship?
No, it wasn't a fancy ship. And when you said ship, I tried to be a tough soldier. You know, you put on that facade. Not mean, but just tough, and I could take anything. So we got on that ship, and the sea got rough. And some of the fellas came down with seasickness, and I was kidding them and talking about, that shouldn't happen to a soldier. And after a while, it hit me. And when you get seasick, your food, if you can eat it, and it comes up. So the thing about it, you don't do anything, but I sat in the corner. And they were calling us out on board ship to take calisthenics. Never forget. And the officer was given orders, and he was on one side of the rail, and we were against the ship, and we were on the outside against the rail, and the soldiers were lined up. And he'd be push down, or when a ship would roll, we'd come down and move into us, and we would run into the water. And we couldn't do much, and that's why he didn't let us go. So I just got sick, and I sat in the corner. And they sent a sergeant to me and told me I had to report to the ship. I had to report outside. I couldn't do that type of thing to sit inside. I said, I'm sick as a dog. And I heard later he was a tough guy. He would really hit you if you didn't do things. And I said, I don't care what happens. I can't get up from this corner. He looked at me and walked away and let me go. But I was sick as a dog. So I'm glad I was drafted into the army and not the Navy. I don't know what I was.
Right. How long did it take you to get up here?
Up to Alaska?
Yes.
It took us several days. Now, I'm going to tell you something that was unique with us. When we left, the war had been declared. Because I remember when I heard about war being declared, about Pearl Harbor, I didn't have a radio myself. But I can never forget the fact that I stood between two tents to hear President Roosevelt give that famous speech.
Hmm.
And so we left. A little while after that to go to Alaska to put that road in, and we did. And I think we were on board around a week. But while we were on board, we thought we saw a Japanese crew on the ship, and we told each other, "My God, we're getting in. They just bombed us out, and we had war with them, and they had them on ships." And when they come among us, we didn't know what to do. We were just staying up, and we didn't try to do anything against them, but we feared for our lives. And we found out it wasn't Japanese, it was Filipinos. Didn't know the difference. But we got there safely. And when we got there, we left America on April the 22nd, and I just looked at my Army discharge papers, and we arrived in Alaska on the 29th of April.
Okay.
Valdez, Alaska. That was our port of disembarkation. It was April, and there was some snow on the ground, but there was beautiful weather. And we just went out to look at the scene in the mountains in the distance. It was so clear. The mountains looked like they were about a block or two or three blocks away.
What company were you with? Were you with headquarters?
Headquarters, yes.
What did they call?
Right.
H&S. And what was your assignment?
I was a draftsman, a structural designer. And I was in charge of operations and intelligence, which meant that I filed very confidential papers that came from the Pentagon. I saw that everything was kept in order, because nobody was over me there, because I learned from an old sergeant, an old black sergeant, well, all of our enlistment were black, and the commission officers were white. And our chaplain, Chaplain Smith in New York, was a chaplain, but that was the only commissioned officer who was black. This old sergeant told me, he said, you in a position where you're going to get a man over you all the time who's going to be at least a major. He said, but you're not going to see him, because from major on, it becomes political. To get to be a lieutenant colonel, you've got the soldier or a commissioned officer has to politic, has to get friendly with the powers that be. So you won't see anybody much. But one day, Major Coleman came in, as I told you when he called, I don't know if you remember or not, and he was coming in to be in charge of the operations and intelligence. But he didn't stay there long either. In other words, I ran it all myself, with nobody over me. And I had to be responsible. And one of the things, when I read those secret orders that were given many times and filed them away, when I went back many times, they were gone. Nobody took them out. Nobody did anything for it. But what I did not do, I didn't talk to anybody about it. So I never gave out any information.
And when you first got to Valdez, where did you live? Did you set up camp?
Yeah, we set up camp.
Where?
We set up tents.
Tents? How many of you were there?
It was a regiment. Now, how many men are in a regiment? There's the whole 97th Regiment, Engineer General Service Regiment.
Okay.
Set up board that ship. And this is the incident that occurred. We watched them take things off with those big derricks, and they took so much stuff off. We didn't know where that stuff came from. And after a while, I saw full coffins being taken off, and I got angry. I said, "We're not going to fight." Of course, maybe I was saying it because I didn't want to be killed. And I said, "I don't see why they're bringing those coffins off there." And a fellow said, "Somebody's going to die." Sure enough, a fellow in our outfit froze to death while we were in Alaska. He was trying to get to camp and couldn't make it. And when they went back for him, he was frozen solid in a sitting position. And I never will forget, I went in and saw him. He was sitting in that position. They put him in a warm tent to warm him up, and it took 2 days for him to thaw out before they could embalm him. So we did lose a soldier to having been frozen.
When was that? Shortly after you got there? Well, you're skipping ahead a little bit. Let's go back. You're camping in Valdez. The weather is still nice. How long did you stay there, and what did you do there?
We started trying to deal with how we were going to deal with the roads. And because I was the structural designer there, they had me to make a proposal, draw a certain rules. Although we had never been into Alaska, and although it was uncharted, we were trying to get ready and organize. And a few weeks after we got into Alaska, we were sent to Salerno, and that's where we started. Now, never will forget, we started on a hill, and they started trying to cut into that hill, and every time they cut what they thought would be the roadbed, there would be a slide of rocks and dirt, and we stayed there a long time before they overcame that. Now, this, I think, is appropriate at this moment. The motto that I had never thought about for years came to me suddenly. And it's an unusual motto for the 97th Engineer Regiment. The difficult we do immediately, the impossible takes a little longer.
That's nice.
Yes.
So you stayed there about how long?
About 6 weeks in Solano, trying to get that road started before we could. You see, what happened, I think everybody was new to the drain. And the situation that we had to solve problems, and the engineers solved the problem after about 6 weeks of frustration. Then we got started.
Okay, and how often did you move?
I was thinking about that after we talked about they strung the outfits A, B, and C Company all along the road at intervals, miles apart, as far as they could start off with. And they had to, of course, go through very rough terrain to get strung out.
Right.
And then when we would finish a segment, and it would be Sunday, so I think I remember one time when we finished Saturday, we had finished our duty, and we thought we were going to relax. And they came out and told us we will move tomorrow. So we worked 7 days out of the week. And every time we got a segment started, we sort of leapfrogged ahead of the other company to lengthen out that road. That's how we worked.
Okay.
So we didn't have any time at all to ourselves. Now, when we went there, it was in April, and the sun wasn't going down much. So we were amazed at what we saw. In the summer, it never got dark. In the winter, it never got to be light.
Right. When the fellow froze, what part of the highway were you on then?
I don't know, but it was day in the wintertime. So that happened, as you told me, I jumped a bit. That was surely after we started, after we left that camp, that abandoned gold mine.
Okay, when did you move to the abandoned gold mine?
That was in the winter. It had to be in the winter of 42, and I read that was the coldest winter on record.
It was after
we were put in. I don't know just what day we went in, but we stayed there a long time.
Do you remember how far? Do you remember how far you were from Solana at that point? Was it after Christmas? Did you spend Christmas there?
Well, now you're saying Christmas. Now you're making me connect up that we did spend Christmas in that camp, and I can tell you why. You saw the men in the camp, or the picture that I sent, is that
yes.
Right? One fellow who drove a truck said that he knew a place to get a radio, a shortwave radio, battery operated. We put our money in together. We brought it in, and we tuned in stations. And now I know we were there for Christmas because we heard Bing Crosby for the first time sing, "I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas." And we played that as many times as we could.
Did he go up to Fairbanks to get the radio, do you suppose?
I don't know where he went, but this guy was a slick guy. He's dead now. He lived back in Biloxi, Mississippi, and I called somebody after I knew they were trying to get the fellas to go and have this reunion, and they told me Coleman is dead. He and I became very friends. He also dealt with heavy equipment. And they say that the black men, most of them didn't have more than a grade school education. Some of them couldn't read or write. And that's when I read an article that was publicized in dealing with the Alcan Highway, as you say now, Alaska, we said Alcan Highway. They said they couldn't learn how to deal with that heavy equipment. And they learned how to deal with that heavy equipment, and I mean they were masters at it.
Do you remember what Coleman's first name was?
I don't know, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I tried to think of it. If you have a chance to talk to Atkinson,
he'll know.
Yes.
Okay.
Because he was a medic, and we all knew him.
Right. Well, was the dead soldier the same one he was with you at that time? He was the guy who actually embalmed him.
No, he didn't embalm him, but there was a fella. I don't know this fella's name, but he was a very neat guy. And he said before he came to the Army, he was an embalmer. And he was there when I walked in, and I asked him, could I look at the body? He said, yes. And I said, who's going to embalm me? He said, I was an embalmer before I came here. As soon as I can get him to relax to a reclining position, I will start embalming. And then I'd never go back.
I'll be darned. I think it's the same one that Atkinson was telling me about.
Most likely it was.
Yeah.
A very fine fellow, a very intelligent fellow.
He'd started walking from his truck?
This fellow that embalmed him, he was attached to the medics.
No. The soldier who died had been walking from his truck when he froze to death.
No. He was been on foot.
He was what?
He was on foot with the lieutenant, they say. They were out somehow.
Right. I say walking from their truck. He was on foot. Right. Same guy.
I don't know how he got out there. I just heard that he had frozen to death. I didn't know him. But they say they were trying to get back to camp when a blizzard occurred. And the officer tried to talk him into continuing.
Right.
Said, I'm sorry. He just went on and he said he was comfortable. You know, they say you feel warm and you sleep in the snow. And the officer said he couldn't get into. And the officer had to come on in himself or else both of them would have frozen.
Yeah.
So there was a white officer and a black soldier together. Now, they could have been doing anything, but you see, having been from the south, they didn't know the weather there. And things would, sometimes blizzards would come up almost suddenly. But that chili was after Christmas, you know, around that time.
Okay.
And it was very cold.
Okay, well, you must have moved into the gold mine when the weather got really nasty and just
we
put...
We moved in before it got nasty because, I'm saying this, they must have known it was going to be nasty. Now, I know we were there before it was nasty because after 5 o'clock, when we'd get off from work, they told us it was an abandoned gold mine, and it was round sort of rocks in there, smooth rocks. And we saw little things that glistened, I mean, glittered like pure gold. I mean, it was beautiful. And so we thought they just left the little pieces of gold for anybody who wanted them, like you do with any big operation. And so we went in there with hammers and chiseled it out. I've got a little matchbox full of it now, and it's black. And we thought they did it with water. I think it was hydraulic mining they did. So they forced it out. Well, they used water all the time.
Were there a lot of wooden buildings there?
Yes. There was that little building that we in had four bunks on eight men in one little cabin. We called them cabins. They were lined up out there.
Okay.
And when it got cold, we were still there. And I remember they called us out to meet Reveille one morning, and it was a blizzard going on the night before. When we got out there, the snow was hip deep.
Huh.
And from then on, they told us we won't call Reveille anymore. Where would we have gone? You see, when we said about our beds, there are certain things that had to be overlooked. They wanted to keep our morale up, and that's what they do in the Army. They keep you down to doing the things you should do, the humdrum, the daily duty, to keep you from having low morale. But after a while, they found out that they had to stop this. And so they just let us alone. That's when the beds start. That's when we started growing the beard when he started getting cold and he moved into those cabins.
Quit. You know, there's a gold mine up at Solana. I'll bet you were up there.
It must have been. It must have been because we left there and we went and it didn't take any time to go to Solana. So since you were there, I would agree with you. It must have been right close. It may have been in Solana.
Yeah, I think so. Okay.
But that's the last time we saw, though, when we got out and started Bay Road. I thought about that. Because I said I should think about the little
towns
we hit. We didn't hit any towns yesterday.
No. You stayed there through Christmas. Do you remember you were very long after Christmas? Of course, with all that snow, you couldn't do much building, could you?
No.
What did you do?
We had to go get one time. The officer of the whole camp, where we were, said you all have got to go out today and bring lumber in, bring trees in, find all you can and bring it into this open spot in the camp. He said, if you don't do it, you're going to freeze to death. And I remember I was working with a captain, and he got so tired because I was in good condition. I had been an athlete all my life, and still I was still an athletic. And he was first mine. So that was my way of getting back at him. And he said, I'm sorry, I'll be back. And he never came back. I worked it so hard. This is the one time I could work an officer.
So you all went out and chopped lumber to just to keep warm, or
no,
trees?
Yes, no, we went out and dragged logs in so we could go to it and chop it when we needed it. Because we just kept fires going all the time. We had to.
Were those buildings fairly warm?
Yes, they were comfortable. They were very comfortable. Yeah, we didn't suffer any cold in those buildings. So they were built there, and they were pretty well built. We didn't feel any draft, any breeze, any wind coming in.
Was it A, B, and C company, or just had... What companies were there?
Well, you know something? I'm a type of guy who never did try to go out and investigate about other people.
Were there lots of people?
H&S. In other words, I stayed close to where we were.
Right, it sounds like you separated. I know A company, for instance, was working their way down the road, so they couldn't...
A company, B company, C company, we were separated. Now, what I'm really saying is, H&S, because being headquarters, maybe we moved just there, and because we were the ones where everything, the hub of what took place there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's why H&S company was there, so they could keep in touch with us. Now, you see, we could go and work in headquarters building, because we had a place to work there. So we had it better than the other ones as far as meeting the weather. In fact, I didn't have to go out into the weather to wake. I had to go out there to take a cruise of men to put the snow poles in and to check on chlorinate water and things like that. But I didn't have to do any manual work at all because I was a college graduate and I had a high IQ, and so I had office work and had a paperwork to do.
And how long did you stay at the gold mine? Just was it close to spring when you left?
Yeah, no. There I lose track. After a while, the monotony of being there, and snow, and the aurora borealis, the northern lights, which were beautiful, frightened some men who had never seen it before, but I had studied in school, and even in grammar school, so I knew what it was, and it was fantastic. It's like Broadway was so but it was different colors. I remember one night I went to an officer's camp, and I was talking to him. Talking about something, and this man knew I was a college graduate. I forget his name now, but he's very nice to me. And he asked me about the word irregardless. And I told him that President Roosevelt used the word irregardless. He said, I know it. He said, now I looked up in the dictionary, and it's not there. And I told him, I said, well, I thought it was there, and I said, I'm going to look it up for a chance I get. And I found out that irregardless was not in the dictionary. I don't know whether it's been put in since, but I do know this, that President Roosevelt always said irregardless. He didn't say regardless. Regardless was there, but not irregardless. But he was powerful enough to make us to coin words.
Right. So you were talking about the monarchy. Did it get to you?
Well, it didn't get to me for one basic reason. It's because of my attitude. My mother told me that when I was a little baby, I had two sisters before me. She had a carriage then. It was just my age, so forth. They'd take us out in carriages, my mother said she'd play whist. And she said while she was watching my two sisters who preceded me in birth, they would have to be attended to. They would cry. And she said, I wouldn't do anything. She'd be concerned about me and go look at me, and I'd be looking at my little hands. She said, you're just looking at your hands. She said, you were a good baby. I never bother anybody. I've always been able to be by myself because I've always wanted to draw, and I drew before I knew anything. I always managed to occupy myself. I'd read. And since you said about how do we occupy ourselves, anybody would talk to me, they'd realize that I liked to read. There was a little fella, forget his name, he was an attendant to the officers there, officers mess. And he found out I liked to read, and he'd bring me Time magazine from the officer so I could read. So I spent a lot of time reading Time magazine.
That's great.
You know, you're making me recall things that I hadn't brought up in my memory. So I appreciate this.
Okay, I need to know when you got out of there. You stayed there one god awful long time. I suspect you probably didn't move till spring because you couldn't do anything. You couldn't build anything.
No. So, I don't think the promise was made until it sort of started to thaw out. But
yeah.
Once they got the momentum going, I was amazed at how fast they traveled that road.
When you finally got out of the winter camp, was there quite a lot of road already built?
Yes, some of it was built then, yes. Because then we went in, we moved in army trucks.
Okay.
And we moved many times, even we went to on furlough in the plane. You know how we moved in those big army trucks covered with canvas? We'd get in our sleeping bags.
Huh.
To keep them freezing. And having been an athlete, I'd keep flexing my muscles to keep the blood circulating. I never would forget that.
I suppose if you didn't, you'd be in trouble.
Yes. And I remember Sergeant Love was from Chicago. He and I were in a two-man tent. And one morning I woke up, and it was snowing. It was the snow was all over the ground. And I saw nothing but frost around where his mouth was in that canvas, sleeping bag. And I thought he was dead. And I was afraid to shake him, and I shook him. And I said, you don't know how glad I am. I said, I thought you was dead. He smiled at me. Icicles were inside our tent when we first went there. I don't know why he must have been freezing to death.
I'll be done.
As I told you, we wore leather shoes and socks. And some of the fellas got a frostbite on their feet, on their toes. And they devised a method of taking thick woolen socks and putting them in rubber galoshes. And that kept us warm.
And, how was morale and discipline? Any discipline problems while you were out there on the road? Or?
No, strange as it may seem, when we went into Valdez, they restricted us to the ship that before we got off. The officers went to Valdez, Alaska. And when we got off and we were able to go around the city, and I'm glad you asked that because there were a lot of Indians there. We thought Eskimos, but they were Indians there because it was Eskimos, they say, were further up north. And, the lady at a store, I never forget, told us after we had stayed there and gone into the store and bought things and so forth, she said, you know, they told us you won't be disorderly. She said, I want to tell you so you can conduct yourself in a nice manner. So that answers your question there.
Right.
We were different from the young people growing up now. Although segregation was a closed thing for us, we always, and especially for my family, and having the background of in American missionary schools in the Congregational Church, we were conservative in our actions. So I was never like that. And I think I had an influence over the men around me because I think the way a person conducts himself, and since I was promoted by the time I went to Alaska, I have always, by example, led men. Even my students, I lead people. And people say I've inspired them to go to grad school. I inspire them to live better because that was instilled into me at an early age by my mother and my father.
Let's see, we backtracked to Valdez, but you actually moved out in the spring, and then how did you spend the next summer?
I didn't mosquitoes. I mean some big mosquitoes. They come down and bomb us, so you're asking that, yes. And we'd see the birds eat the mosquitoes, yes. And then they had what they call grouse. Do they still have that?
Sure.
It's like chickens.
Yeah.
And they didn't know, to show you that we went where nobody had ever been, they wouldn't run from us. They wouldn't fly away. They wouldn't walk. I didn't know anything. But the guys would take sticks and kill those grouse and cook them.
Did you get any other wild game?
Yes. As you said, I told you we had two cub bears, which we had to let go, and they'd go in the fellas' pockets and play around on the campus. So that's one way they occupied time, too, because we didn't have any place to go. And what the cook they go out and shoot animals because if the food didn't come in, they had a source of food there. And they shot a bear. And while I was eating, somebody told me we were eating bear meat. And I think that was the mother bear. And the cubs grew up and had to run go. But one time I heard, and I'm going to ask you this because they told me this. Now, many times guys lied to while away the time. They said they shot a porcupine. Do they have porcupines there?
Yeah, they sure do. Great big ones in that country.
Well, I'm glad to tell you this. And they said they shot a porcupine and cooked him.
Yeah, a porcupine's pretty good.
Well, you see, now you verifying something for me there. And so they used to get a lot of salmon, too. And the thing about it, when they picked those salmon up by hand, because you'd hear them fighting, and it was, you couldn't believe it, but they would swim in shallow water to fight their way upstream. And fellas would go into the stream, pick up the salmon, and turn them up, and the eggs would fall out, just by the hundreds.
Yeah.
Going up there to spawn.
Yeah. And where were you?
Salmon, so they had a lot of salmon being cooked. And well, of course, we had a lot of spam, you know. That's when I first learned about spam.
Right.
And powdered eggs, don't forget that. We had a lot of that.
Probably seen enough
of... Powdered milk, too. Powdered milk and powdered eggs. We had a lot of that. Monotonous.
And then, as the summer wore on, you moved on down towards the Canadian border. Did you ever get into Whitehorse?
May I ask you this?
Yeah.
Now, when we left on our furloughs and flew out on Army planes, we flew into Whitehorse, Canada. So we must have been above Whitehorse. Is that not right?
Well, you could have been below it. There were airfields all over the place. But you probably got as far as Delta, which was where the Tanana River is.
Well, may I say this? I didn't know until I read some literature that we were the only black outfit that were in Alaska. The rest of the other outfits were in Canada.
Right.
The road went through Canada, didn't it?
Right.
So that's why I thought we were above that, because we flew into Whitehorse and Winnipeg. We went into those two.
Was it long after you bridged the Tanana River that you got your furlough?
Yes, it was after that. So that gives you a chance to know where I was. Is that not right?
Right. Nobody told you crossed the Canadian border, right?
No.
Okay, then. You were somewhere between Delta. Did you ever go, do you remember a place called Toke?
No.
Okay.
Dawson Creek. Where is that?
Oh, that's way, way south. That's the southern terminus of the Alcan Highway. That's the railhead.
Well, we heard about that. And the way we got mail, these bush pilots would fly the mail in. And some of them would get killed in those planes. Those little planes, you know?
Right.
And they were very, very skillful men. But we got mail very seldom. And that was another thing. We looked forward to reading mail. And sometimes I'd get five letters maybe, and sometimes you'd get two and three, but we looked forward to, and one thing, I don't do it now, but we'd answer that mail, please believe me.
Did you ever see any newspaper reporters or photographers?
No. The photographers were Waddy Thomas and a guy by the name of Eugene Griggs, and I lived with Waddy Thomas for a great deal. He and I were together a long time. That's why I used to watch him develop a photograph.
Was he just doing this on his own?
No, he was working for the Army.
He was with your outfit then?
Yes, he was with H&S. And also, there's a picture I sent to you with him standing with me in front of a command call. I remember I sent that picture to you. That's a time exposure, because I didn't know you could do this. He said, I'm going to take my picture today. And I said, you can't take your picture. He said, yes, I can. So they had good cameras. So he set the time exposure, ran over, and I heard some sort of them winding thing in the camera. Take pictures that way, take it off.
And he was black?
Yes, he was black. He was from New Orleans.
Okay.
See, several of us from New Orleans got into that outfit together. Because they see when they were announced fast, they were rounding them up from New Orleans.
Okay. Yeah, when we get to doing a book, I'm going to ask for permission to use some of those pictures in it. I think it would be good.
Yes, it is. You may use them all.
Great.
And if I have any others that you need, I'll look around and say, yeah. May I tell you this?
Yeah.
I am so grateful, Professor Morgan, that this is being done. You don't know how much I am grateful. I thought we were going to be forgotten, because I've read things about this. And when Atkinson sent me this article that the fellow from Houston, Texas wrote, you know?
Yeah.
And he said the same thing. I had just given up hope because I'd read and had never said anything about the 97th engine, the L-15, or anything about flight. So that's a fact. They just wrote us out of the history. And that's why I commend you for what you do.
Oh, I got pretty discouraged along the way, but it's been worth it.
I think all of us ought to be grateful. This is why I'm glad to call. This is why any contribution I can make, please believe me, I'll make it. Thank God for you.